Good morning, Chief Justice Steele. May it please the court, William Fletcher on behalf of the Yoder appellants. This matter is presently before the court as a result of two decisions of the lower court. One in December of 2003 dealing with the choice of law where the lower court ruled that as to contributory negligence, Maryland law would be applied to this case, and a later ruling by the same court granting the defendants, both Delmarva Power and Light Company and Mr. Longarm, summary judgment of dismissal under Maryland law.
Mr. Fletcher, I don't want to take much of your valuable time, but can you explain why it took 5 years to get from the first opinion to the second opinion? I understand that the first, as you pointed out, was 2003, and the second was 2008. Why so long?
Your Honor, I think the primary reason for that dealt with the physical condition and mental condition of the plaintiff, Noah Yoder. There had been a lot of issues about his competency, and eventually a court doctor was appointed.
Thank you.
As I'm sure the court is aware, this matter arose from an electrocution that occurred in Millington, Maryland, when Mr. Yoder was working on the working with the roof of a house owned by a Mr. Tostin. This was a two-story residence. This was the first time that Mr. Yoder had been working on the roof of the house, of the second floor, and he was applying sealant to the roof as part of his work. The record shows that Mr. Yoder was simply a handyman. He had no expertise in electronics. He had never worked for a power or electrical company, and he had no licenses as it relates to the use of electricity. And
Does the record confirm that this is the first time that he worked on the roof at that premises?
On the second-story roof, I believe it does, Your Honor.
Second-story roof?
Yes.
But he'd been to the premises before. Was it similarly situated as on this occasion when he was there before?
I believe so, Your Honor, but I don't believe he had ever was involved in a repair job that involved the second-story roof before this occasion.
And your inference there is that it's higher than what he had worked on before?
Yes. And as it turns out, as a result of him using Mr. Longarm's product, which was a pole extender that would enable him to attach a roller to the end of it so that he could reach longer and cover more area of the roof while he was applying it, during that, as the only witness post-incident described it, both he and the pole, he was seen falling from the ladder to the ground. It is uncontroverted in the record before the court that Delmarva Power and Light Company was negligent in its location of the high-voltage wire involved. It is also uncontroverted that that high-voltage wire was not running over the house and was not in the field of Mr. Yoder's work. It was rather behind him and above him.
Now, Mr. Fletcher, just so I can follow your argument, are you telling all of this to us because you're saying the Maryland law was improperly applied, or does it relate in some way to your choice of law argument?
Your Honor, I would say that these facts that I've just recited really would be relevant to the issue of whether even under Maryland law, contributory negligence existed as a matter of law.
Okay.
But turning, and briefly, I just wanted to outline what happened. As we presented the case to the lower court, the issue arose as to whether Delaware or Maryland law should apply as to the conduct of Mr. Yoder as it relates to whether or not there should be an absolute or a proportionate bar to his recovery of damages. Delaware has accepted and has adopted by legislative act the comparative negligence statute, which allows an injured party to recover his damages from a wrongdoer, provided that his own conduct is not considered to be more negligent than that of the defendant.
In order to save your time, assume that we all know comparative negligence and contributory negligence and the difference between them, and go right to the point of whether Maryland's contributory negligence law or Delaware's comparative negligence law should apply.
Your Honor, we believe that the proper application under this factual setting is that Delaware law should apply on the issue of Mr. Yoder's negligence. We say that in using the concepts developed by this court in Travelers Indemnity Company versus Lake, and in looking at the factors that the court identified in that case under the restatement. Delmarva Power and Light Company is a Delaware incorporated entity. Its principal place of business is in Delaware. Its engineering and safety design work is done in Delaware. And its the majority of its customers are in Delaware.
Now, if that is determinative and your position prevails, the result would be that everything Delmarva does in Maryland is going to be decided under Delaware law. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. And I say that because, as the restatement notes, you must look at each issue of law and determine what state has the most significant relationship to that issue.
All right. We'll narrow it down to negligence, to the extent that Delmarva puts up wires anywhere in Maryland in a negligent way. Based on the factors you listed, it would always be subject to Delaware's law.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Tell me then how I misunderstood your argument.
Your Honor, when we talk about DP&L's negligence, and that's talking about the tortious conduct itself, whether it was negligent, we do not argue that Delaware law would dictate that rather than Maryland law. We do not argue that even whether or not Mr. Yoder's conduct was tortious or breached a standard of care should be determined under Delaware law. What we do argue is that that Delaware's law, as it relates to a bar on damages, should be the applicable rule and not the absolute bar of Maryland as it relates to damages. In other words, we're not saying Delaware law determines whether the line was too close to the house or was a hazard. That would be determined under Maryland law. And in fact, Delmarva admits it's going to be determined under the National Electric Safety Code.
What's in the logic of applying Maryland law to everything except damages? We say Maryland law is going to apply to everything in this case except damages because?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, because in this particular case, because the lower court made that ruling on damages and no one has appealed it. In other words, the lower court has already ruled on the issue of damages. Delaware law will be applied. Maryland, for instance, has a statutory cap on damages, and the lower court ruled that statutory cap will not apply in this case. And what we're arguing is we're just one step removed from the statutory cap. We're dealing with contributory negligence, which is an absolute cap or a total bar to the recovery of damages. But it relates to damages because the lower court and us believe that the factors all relate to Delaware having the most significant contact. For instance,
well, I thought there was a distinction in tort law between liability and damages. And a cap on damages, I can understand. But characterizing the bar of contributory negligence as a cap on damages confuses me, because I thought contributory negligence went to liability, not damages.
Well, Your Honor, the terminology may be you can certainly use the concept that the defendant is not liable. But what is happening is,
well, aren't you trying to shoehorn what's really a liability issue into a damages issue because you've got a favorable ruling on the damages cap? That is, let's talk in terms of liability and see where your argument goes. That is, what would your argument be for getting damages?
My argument, Your Honor, is when we look at the criteria of the restatement, the most important criteria are, what are the relevant policies of the forum state? That's the state of Delaware, in dealing with these parties. One, a Delaware corporation whose principal place of business is here and whose activities here determined the setup of the electrical system at the site.
But I thought the critical analysis was which state had the most significant relationship. Here, plaintiff, the injured party, was a resident citizen of Maryland. The accident took place in Maryland. The treatment, except for some post, a little bit of post-accident treatment, took place in Maryland. The only Delaware contacts are that Delaware is a state of incorporation of one of the defendants, Delmarva, which also has a principal place of business here. And I'm not sure what the Delaware contact, if any, is with the other corporate defendant.
Your Honor, with the other corporate...
So, you know, in those circumstances, tell me, as Justice Holland asked, if you're going to, you know, if Maryland, despite those facts, is the most, is the state with the most significant contact, tell us why, legally, that's the case.
Your Honor, when you say it in the most significant contacts, under the restatement, we look at a number of elements to reach that final determination that it is the most significant place of contact. For instance, it's mentioned in 145, place of injury. But it's also mentioned, where are the parties, where do they reside, what are their contacts, where are they incorporated, which state? And it also mentions, what is the relationship, where was the place of the relationship of the parties created?
I'm looking not for mush, but for solid rock. Now, what in your argument is solid rock? Something that you can write in a sentence or two sentences that makes legal sense.
What makes sense, Your Honor, I believe, is that you look at both parties. Yes, Mr. Yoder lived in Maryland at the time of the incident, but he worked in Maryland and Delaware. He and his family went
he
to...
He may have also traveled in Europe. He may have flown into outer space if he were an astronaut, but why is that relevant?
Well, it's relevant to look at the contacts that Mr. Yoder had to Delaware. He's not a stranger to Delaware. He had work in Delaware. His family went to school in Delaware. His family went to church in Delaware.
And why is that significant in this context?
It's significant.
We're talking about an injury that took place in a moment of time on a specific occasion.
We are, Your Honor, and that fact alone, Your Honor, and many of the courts that have analyzed choice of law issues, that moment in time has been designated to be fortuitous and tends not to be the factor that the courts latch onto and find to be qualitatively the most important factor.
You haven't told us, though, and that's what I'm asking, which factors are qualitatively determinative and why?
The qualitative factors that are determinative are not only Mr. Yoder's relationship and his family with Delaware, but more importantly, DP&L's relationship. They not only have incorporated here, but they have their principal place of business here, and their safety and engineering department is here
so,
in
so
Delaware.
So your proposition is that if one of the corporate defendants is a Delaware corporation and has a principal place of business here, then Delaware law will apply except Delaware law will apply with respect to the issue of contributory negligence, but not with respect to any other issues. Is that your proposition?
My proposition, Your Honor, is that Delaware law on contributory negligence should apply, yes.
But would your argument be any different if this hypothetically had been an auto accident with a DP&L vehicle and Mr. Yoder in a car?
The only difference, Your Honor, would be that in that case, there may not be evidence that DP&L's conduct regarding the erection, the maintenance, and the safe location of its wires, in our case, may not be present in an automobile case. Nevertheless, in an automobile case, the courts have made it very clear that the location of the automobile accident is clearly fortuitous and really has little bearing and is low on the hierarchy of issues that should be considered. What should be considered are the policies of the forum and, again, the basic policies underlying the particular field of law. And the particular field of law in this case is whether or not this court is going to use a legislatively enacted comparative negligence statute, which 46 states also use, or whether it's going to use the arcane and what has been clearly described as inequitable doctrine of contributory negligence. And this court, because the case is in Delaware, because it is the forum state, this court has the right to determine which of those underlying policies it thinks is most appropriate, and does that constitute a qualitative reason to use Delaware law?
You sound, it sounds to me like you're suggesting that just comes out of a vacuum, that we use Delaware social policy to supplant the social policy of another sister state with which we disagree. I thought the way in which we approach choice of law is similar to what you describe on page 12 of your brief, that on the issues of comparative or contributory negligence, the law of the state where the injury occurred applies unless another state has a more significant relationship to the occurrence and the parties. And in Restatement 145.2, the kinds of contacts to be taken into consideration to consider that relationship are the place where the injury occurred, the place where the conduct causing the injury occurred, and so on. As you outline those A, B, C, and D on page 12 of your brief, can you describe for us how Delaware fits into those contexts?
Yes, Your Honor. Those four categories that are mentioned, a place where the injury occurred obviously is Maryland. But the place where the conduct causing the injury occurred, we contend, is Delaware.
The conduct that caused the injury was placing an uninsulated wire at an improper height in Maryland, correct?
That's where it was placed, but the determination of where it would be placed and the maintenance of it and the constant ongoing process of determining safe location of wires is done in Delaware.
The decision to place it where it was placed in the manner in which it was constructed, I'll use that term, by that I mean uninsulated, and wasn't triggered to turn off at a magic moment when danger was apprehended, that was done by a crew in Maryland, wasn't it? It may be contrary to DP&L policy set in Wilmington, but the actual conduct that ultimately resulted in the injury physically took place in Maryland, didn't it?
It did, Your Honor, but we would suggest that is the key decision is made by the people who tell the riggers where to put things. If the riggers were told to put this in the right place, we wouldn't be here.
Well, what does the record show about who told who what?
The record shows, as far as it was developed, Your Honor, is that those considerations are made by the engineering people in Delaware.
No, I understand your point that they set the policy. But when the policy is violated in the field, and the field is a field in Maryland, it's that violation of the policy that caused the injury. That's the conduct that caused the injury. How can it be both inconsistent with the policy set by DP&L and be caused in Wilmington or in Delaware?
Your Honor, because the testimony is that DP&L has an ongoing proactive engineering program to constantly determine and evaluate its locations of its wiring throughout the system and whether or not it is safely located given the types of activities that are expected to occur.
Okay, let's assume that program was set in place in Delaware but wasn't followed in Maryland. The failure to follow it in Maryland is the conduct that caused the injury, correct?
The allowance of the location to remain there I mean, this wire had been there, Your Honor. This wasn't just put up a week before this accident. It's my understanding that this wiring had been there for some time. So it was the failure to analyze and determine whether or not that location was properly set. But I certainly agree. It's because of where it was. It is why we had the electrocution.
Doesn't your claim really boil down to the idea that we should find it repugnant to Delaware's policies to apply contributory negligence?
That is certainly one of our key elements, Your Honor. Yes,
and if I realize there are some other things that you're able to tack on to it, but if we agree that that's the principal factor under the restatement. Then my question is, it's not contributory negligence may have been modified in most jurisdictions, and it may be viewed as a less fair standard. But we're not talking about confiscatory. We're not talking about a situation where there is no relief, you're barred, you cannot bring a claim in Maryland for negligence. We're talking about a different standard that we may not agree with. Why should that control the result?
Well, Your Honor, I think it is certainly an important element as to what the result should be, for one reason, because the restatement has indicated that this is what courts consider to be an important element, that is the basic policies underlying the particular field of law. And unfortunately, the policy of contributory negligence is that a wrongdoer, no matter even if they're 99% at fault, a wrongdoer is not held responsible for their wrongful acts. And that is, by our legislative enactment, is clearly repugnant to Delaware law. Delaware law, by statute, says in all actions where a plaintiff is contributory negligent.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Sorry about that, Mr. Fletcher. You just have to pack a wallop in the last 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice Steele, Justices. My name is Summers Price. I'm here on behalf of Delmarva Power and Light Company today. Mr. Edwards and I have divided the time 15 minutes to Delmarva Power and Light and 10 minutes to Mr. Longarm. I'd like to go right to one of the issues that had just come up, which was one of the issues about contributory negligence. at the last argument, before this argument en banc, there were some questions asked about the other jurisdictions that had not adopted comparative negligence in some form. Those jurisdictions are Alabama, which obviously is not near Maryland, but the other jurisdictions are the District of Columbia, Virginia, and North Carolina, all areas in and around the state of Maryland. And in terms of policy, it's one of the parts of the country where that policy is still recognized. Also, there were some questions regarding the legislation in Maryland since the Harrison case was decided in 1983. The Harrison case recites to 16 prior attempts to modify the contributory negligence doctrine in Maryland. Since that time, there have been at least 8 additional attempts, all of which have been rejected. That can be found in the Maryland General Assembly website if the court has any interest to follow that. It was a question that came up. I thought that we owed it to the court to explain that, to make sure that the court was aware of it. The most recent rejection occurred in 2007.
Mr. Price.
Yes, Your Honor.
Moving away for a moment from the choice of law issue, Mr. Fletcher's alternative argument is that even if Maryland law does apply,
yes,
that it was error for the trial court to grant summary judgment because there are material issues of fact as to whether or not there was contributory negligence. What is your response to that?
The answer is that the response, although there were issues of fact, they were not material issues of fact under the Maryland law. Maryland has a significantly different standard in recognizing and analyzing the law with regard to contributory negligence on line contact cases such as this, and I've set most of those out in the brief, and Judge Vaughn also discussed them in his opinion. Specifically, Your Honor, I know one of the issues that they were bringing up was the issue about whether there was some kind of visual illusion. The subjective knowledge of the individual is not the standard under Maryland line contact cases. If you look at the Lipscomb case, the Blanchard case, and the whole line of cases throughout, there are repeated cases where the people say they didn't even see the line above them, or they did not see the line because there were other things that were confusing them, just as Dr. Francis tried to bring up in her issue. That argument is rejected time and time again by the Maryland court in applying summary judgment matter of law determinations on contributory negligence. Judge Vaughn, I think, particularly pointed out there was what he characterized in his opinion as a nest of wires that was above where Mr. Yoder was going to work on the date of the incident. And in that situation, he was placed both under the common law and also under the Maryland High Voltage Act. Immediately on inquiry, first of all, he had to presume that all of those lines were high voltage lines by statutory duty and by the earlier common law decisions, Your Honor. Second, once he did that, it was his statutory obligation and his common law obligation under Maryland law to, at that point, make the situation safe, to contact the utility, or to take an affirmative act. Mr. Fletcher attempted to indicate that somehow Delmarva's negligence was relevant in this particular issue, and it's not under the Maryland line contact cases. That's brought out in one of the more recent cases, the Stancil case, where the court actually went even further and said not only was the individual in that case, who again claimed that there wasn't some form of, there was some kind of illusion, he couldn't properly see things.
Okay, so you're saying, one, that it was, it's presumed either as a matter of common law or under the statute or both, that Mr. Yoder knew that he was dealing with a dangerous situation here, and secondly, under the Act, knowing that it was his duty to contact Delmarva, in effect to have them shut off the power during the time that he would be working near that line.
And he was not to work until that was done. Chief Justice Steele at one point questioned whether Mr. Yoder had been on the roof before. The interrogatory answers that we cite in the appendix indicate that he had worked on the roof. There was no separation whether it was the lower roof or the upper roof. He put on what was called a Conklin roofing system, according to the interrogatory answers, and they are included in Delmarva's appendix, Your Honor.
As you described the common law duty under Maryland law, is it materially different than our oft-pled failure to keep a proper lookout? That is, to see what is there to be seen?
In the case of electrical contacts, I think it goes further. There was, and this goes back, Your Honor, into even the 1940s with a case called Lavonis that's also discussed in our brief. This is a long, very carefully set out common law analysis, but it is a duty to look out, but it's given a much higher standard because of the presence of electricity and electric lines in the decisions that have been issued by the Maryland courts and by the U.S. District and Circuit courts that have also interpreted Maryland law.
Well, is it almost impossible to prevail against the power company in Maryland then? And should that factor into our choice of law analysis?
I think it should not, Your Honor, because there have been, Maryland has carefully laid this out and reaffirmed its social policy. And one of the issues in the choice of law issue is whether or not the jurisdiction where the incident occurred had a strong policy with regard to this issue. And by enacting the overhead line contact statute that was put into place many years before, which again does not conflict with Delaware now, because Delaware has put a similar statute into effect in 2001, which is found at 16 Delaware Code Section 7401B through 7408B, which indicates that there's no conflict between the jurisdictions with regard to that subject, that the policy that's behind this is recognized whichever of the two jurisdictions we're talking about. Now, we've had a number of questions, and I don't like to let questions go unanswered. Justice Jacobs, I'm not sure if I answered your questions earlier and completed it or not, but obviously I'm not the one who determines when the questions are asked, but I did want to make sure that I was able to address what Your Honor was concerned with.
You did. My only other question is, what in Maryland would one have to show in order to establish a tribal issue of fact in circumstances like this?
Okay. Maryland has placed a much higher duty on workers, such as Mr. Yoder, than it has on children, for example. They discussed a couple cases, the Smith case and the Flippo case, both of which involved children. They had cases that they talked about, again, line contact cases where summary judgment was denied, where there was a known hazard and non-working people were having contact with it. One of the things I found interesting in looking at the issue was the fact that they did not supply any cases that were contrary to what Judge Vaughn held and what we found in our research at all. And we were, you know, we didn't think there were any, but usually sometimes in another jurisdiction someone does find a contrary case. That was simply not found in this particular set of facts. I would go back. Another issue I think that's particularly important in the choice of law, which has been sort of glossed over, but I think is the fact that Delmarva is a public utility, and as a result, Maryland, and this is again unrebutted by the Yoder briefs or anything in the record, it's regulated separately, and all Delmarva's operations in the state of Maryland are regulated exclusively by the Maryland Public Service Commission, which establishes regulations which regulate conduct in how we operate our transmission system and our distribution system in the state of Maryland. A federal statute has now taken over some of the transmission duties, but this was a distribution wire, not the one, the kind that gets out into the public, not the great big towers. Excuse me, Your Honor.
If Maryland has regulatory authority over Delmarva, I assume that Delmarva was in violation of Maryland's regulations in terms of the placement of this wire, right?
I don't know that we necessarily were in violation, and that did not become an issue, nor is it relevant for the motion that's at issue, Your Honor. In line contact cases decided with regard to the contributory negligence defense, whether the line is in violation or not does not become something that's been relevant for the Maryland courts.
So there's no such thing as negligence per se?
There is, but it's not relevant in a line contact case. In fact, there have been cases such as the Stancil case, where it was claimed that the utility was grossly negligent or reckless, and the Maryland court still found in favor of the utility in those decisions, Your Honor.
When you say not relevant, do you mean both to workers and non-workers?
Just to workers, Your Honor, in terms of how that they've made, in some instances, as I indicated, and primarily children, but also in situations where where wires have broken and somebody has come near the wire and been electrocuted, usually again involving non-workers. That's what they've done.
Back in the days when people would install on their home their own TV antenna, mm-hmm. those cases would be treated differently under Maryland law than when a construction worker comes to your home and knows or believes they have to be working at or near wires. Different set of
Slightly different, Your Honor, but with the adoption of the statute, anybody who elects to be up working within 10 feet of the line has the duties placed upon them. And again, those are the same kinds of duties that Delaware has found to be applicable to individuals who work around electrical lines here in Delaware.
Workers and non-workers, both in Maryland and Delaware, have the duty to stop and inquire about the lines, put the utility on notice that they're going to be working around them before they begin their work.
Yes. There were a number of questions about the contacts and the policy issues with regard to this. First of all, I would note that Judge Vaughn did consider in his analysis the policies of the two different states with regard to contributory negligence. He did that evaluation as part of what he was required to do under the Travelers versus Lake analysis, and
we're back to choice of law now.
I'm sorry?
We're back to choice of law now.
Yes, Your Honor. And did make the evaluation. It's specifically discussed in his opinion. It's not something he glossed over. And in that analysis, I would also commend this court to the decision we cited in our brief in the McBride versus Whiting Turner case, which was a similar situation where there was a policy. In that case, it had to do with the statutory employer doctrine. And under that particular case, there were, as there were in this case, corporations involved as defendants who were either had substantial operations in Delaware or were Delaware corporations, but the incident was in Maryland. It involved a business contract that was carried out in Maryland by a worker. In that case, it happened to be a Delaware resident in Maryland. And even in that situation, with that tip, that difference that we do not have in this case, the court found that Maryland law controlled. And this court affirmed that decision in by order. I believe Justice Holland was the one who issued the order, or at least in terms of the court records, the one that was involved in that. A similar case to that is the Kellum case, which we also cited in our brief and which we focused on that. A couple other points I would make with regard to the contributory negligence that haven't come up. As Judge Vaughn pointed out, there were also alternative ways that Mr. Yoder could have proceeded in terms of locating the ladder and also in terms of using safety equipment. There were safety devices called cougar paws he could have put on his feet. There were things such as a chicken ladder, which allows someone to climb on a roof. And this particular roof was a metallic roof, not just a regular roof that Mr. Yoder was going up on, and again, in the record, he was somebody who was involved in installing these Conklin roofs that were involved in this particular case. Also, he was not wearing any type of a safety harness or anything such as that, which could have prevented the fall that he had after the shock occurred. Again, these are things, additional points that Judge Vaughn discussed in his opinion. This was not simply a very quick analysis or anything. There were a number of pages in the opinion where he went through numerous factors. Chief Justice Steele, you also asked about the servicing of the wires, and I think you correctly pointed to the areas I would have pointed out with regard to the record that the people who were doing the work on this line were based out of Delmarva's Centerville, Maryland office. That's where they came from. That's where they went out to do the work. Again, the relationship that existed at the time of the incident was based and grounded in Maryland, as it was in the McBride case. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Philip Edwards from the law firm of Murphy and Landon for defendant Mr. Longarm. The plaintiff has alleged three causes of action against Mr. Longarm in this matter: one, negligence; two, strict liability; and three, breach of warranty for the pole that was used and actually contacted the wire on the date of the incident. Here, as to the negligence claim, the analysis that Mr. Price just went through as to the contributory negligence applies to Mr. Longarm as well. And I would adopt the same arguments that he made a few minutes ago with regard to why Mr. Yoder was negligent on the day and why his contributory negligence bars this action as to Mr. Longarm as well. As to Justice Jacobs' question to as what the factors were, there were two additional ones that applied specifically to Mr. Longarm that also applied to why he was contributory negligent, and that is the fact that he misused the pole for its intended use as well as failed to adhere to the warning on the pole. To address Justice Steele's question as to back in the day when people used to put their own antennas up on their garages, there was a case where that happened. It's cited as the Blanchard case, where an individual was actually carrying a TV antenna and contacted the wire. In that case, he said he didn't see the wire, but the court, under its analysis, still granted summary judgment based on the factor that it's not what he saw. It's an objective analysis as opposed to a subjective analysis. So as to Justice Steele's question as to whether or not this statute or the bar as a summary judgment applies to workers and non-workers, There is no difference because the standard that's looked at is the objective standard, the ordinary reasonable person standard. And under Maryland law has long since decided that anyone over the age of majority, 18 years old, is said to understand the properties of electricity and its dangers. Therefore, the argument from plaintiff's counsel that Mr. Yoder may not have been sophisticated in electricity is irrelevant to this analysis.
Tell us again how, in your client's view, the poll was misused.
The poll was misused. The case law on strict liability in Maryland talks about misuse and failure to adhere to warnings as two separate but yet intertwined concepts. The failure to adhere to the warning can be the misuse of the product. And that, in this instance, is what happened here. Here, in the long line of under strict liability, I'm shifting gears a little bit. This applies to the strict liability issue. The misuse of the product here, there were several misuses of the product. He used it within 10 feet of an electrical line. He didn't contact Delmarva to have the...
Yeah, but we're talking about the pole.
Yes, the pole. Under
how
the strict
did he
liability.
Misuse the pole?
Yes, the misuse of the pole was he used it within 10 feet of an electrical line when they had, as the Superior Court described, a clear, coherent, easily understandable warning not to use it there. As to the strict liability claim, there's three ways to establish strict liability in Maryland. A flaw in making the product, a failure to warn, or a design defect. Here there was no failure to warn, and plaintiff's claim is specifically targeted toward the design defect of the pole. How do you establish the design defect in Maryland? It's the consumer expectation test. It leaves the seller in a condition not contemplated by the ultimate user, which makes it dangerous to him. Here, under the consumer expectation test, the pole was not defectively designed because the name of the pole was Alumiglass. It was clearly metal. To someone as sophisticated, a sophisticated worker or a handyman, as plaintiffs like to refer to him, just as the Maryland courts have said, the properties of electricity are well known and on the objective standard that they understand that if you contact a metal pole into an electrified wire, you're going to get electrocuted. Therefore, under the consumer expectation test, the product was not abnormally dangerous beyond the expectations of the ordinary reasonable person. Now, not only do they need to establish the design defect under the consumer expectation test, they also need to establish that the pole was unreasonably dangerous. And the standard to establish an unreasonably dangerous product is dangerous beyond the knowledge contemplated by the ordinary consumer, with knowledge common to the community. Here, Mr. Yoder actually had more knowledge than the average person in the community. He was a worker. He had been at the house before. He had been there several times. He had worked on the roof. He even has, as to this analysis, he had more knowledge. But again, his knowledge doesn't matter because it's the ordinary reasonable person and it's objective standard. And time again, the courts have held that people should know about electricity and you shouldn't contact the wires. Therefore, plaintiff cannot establish its pole was defectively designed either under the consumer expectation test or establish that the product was unreasonably dangerous. Shifting gears, if plaintiff were to somehow meet that hurdle as to design defect that the under the consumer expectation test or the pole is unreasonably dangerous, then we'd go to defenses. All right, plaintiff establishes there's a design defect. Now we have defenses, misuse and failure to adhere to the warnings.
I thought those were one and the same.
They are. They're separate under the case law, but they're also intertwined. In this case, I believe they're intertwined. In plaintiff's briefs and at the last argument, plaintiff focused heavily on the insufficiency of the warning, that the warning, they didn't have a focus group. They didn't have all these things done. The analysis on the warning cases doesn't go that far. It's very clear and concise that when a warning is given, it's deemed to be heeded and understood and should be followed. If you don't,
right, but your position is, I think we understand, that there was a warning and this plaintiff did not observe it. But then you go on and argue that the failure to observe the warning constitutes, in law, a misuse.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, here, just giving a warning can defeat a design defect claim. But there's also a misuse of the product as well. So it's really his claim is defeated in two ways here. Just the basic failure to adhere to the warning, but then also misusing the product by using it within 10 feet of the line. He was put on notice of that misuse not to do that by the warning. And plaintiff's argument as to the sufficiency of the warning really has no place in the analysis because it's deemed to have been read and heeded. But if you look at, if you compare the warning to the other cases, the warning cases that we cited, the first case is the Simpson case. That was a case where a gas can said, don't keep in living quarters and keep away from children. The same argument was raised here that plaintiffs raised that say, well, the gas can didn't say, if you leave it in the house, children might get burned or the house might blow up. All it said was keep away from children and don't keep in the house. Very similar to here where the line, where the warning said don't get within 10 feet of an electrical line, but it didn't go, plaintiffs say it's insufficient because it didn't go on to say, because if you do, you will be electrocuted. So the Simpson case, the Simpson warning is exactly on point, as well as the Hoon case, the light loader versus Hoon case, where where summary judgment was granted as to a strict liability claim, where there was a light fixture, and the light fixture had a warning on it as well as in the box that said, do not put heat-sensitive insulation within 3 feet of the light fixture. That's exactly on point to this warning, where it says don't get within 10 feet of an electrical line. In that case, the court went on to say the warning was given. It had to be heated and read. Your claim is barred because you didn't adhere to the warning. And they put the insulation next to the light, and it heated up, and there was a fire. The Holiday case, where the warning was given, the Holiday case, is this the Saturday night special case? Oh, this is another gun case where the gun came with a warning and said, do not store under the bed and keep unloaded at the time. The warning didn't go on to say, if you store this gun under the bed and you keep it loaded, a five-year-old child might get the gun and shoot himself. And that's what happened in the case. But the warning was held to be sufficient. It said, don't store under the bed, keep unloaded. That warning was, again, held to be sufficient. And the Holiday case does go on to say, specifically in these terms, the warning only needs to warn not to engage in the behavior. It does not need to spell out the behavior's consequences. That's directly from the Holiday case, which is the warning on the gun case. Here, the warning was given. It was clear. It had danger written on it. It had lightning bolts. It said, keep away from power lines. Judge Vaughn, the Superior Court, described the warning as clear, concise, and easily understandable. Again, plaintiff's claims fail under the strict liability count for the failure under the consumer expectation test, the failure to establish that the product was unreasonably dangerous, the failure for Mr. Yoder to adhere to the warnings, and the failure on Mr. Yoder's misuse of the product. Thank you.
In the time left to me, I would like to refer to the court to our brief, particularly our reply brief at page 15, where we analyze and evaluate the distinguishing factors from the old power line cases that DP&L has cited in its brief to the present matter. There are three cases that I think are important and I would like to refer to. Flippo is the latest Court of Appeals of Maryland case, which held that it was a matter for the jury to decide if there was contributory negligence where the injured party admitted that they knew that wires ran through a tree, that they knew the dangers of electricity, but they didn't know the characteristics of the specific wire that was in the tree. They climbed up the tree, began to fall, grabbed onto the wire, were electrocuted. And the court, after a trial, which we've never had in this case, the court held that it was not a matter of law, contributory negligence, it was appropriate to go to the jury, and the jury found for the injured party. Regarding Mr. Longarm, I believe there are two cases that are important. The Ellsworth case, which is cited, involves a nightgown that a lady wore inside out in her kitchen, and she's reaching over a lit stove, a burner, and the nightgown catches fire, and she is severely burned. The Court of Appeals of Maryland said that using a nightgown in a kitchen is a foreseeable use, even in the area of open burners. And they said that that was not a misuse. Mr. Yoder was using an extension rod to reach parts of a roof to apply a sealant. That is clearly what the pole was meant to do. It is not a misuse. In Ellsworth, the court did say that it's possible that if you have an unreasonably dangerous product, by an adequate warning, you might make the product non-dangerous. But in this case, Your Honor, we contend that there has not been an adequate warning. And we provided two experts in our appendix, Drs. Campbell and Anderson, who have given reports who have stated that the warnings were inadequate, that they did not alert the user to the actual danger, that they did not talk about electrocution, and they did not talk about injury, and they were so small you wouldn't expect anyone to read it. Those are found in our appendix, those reports, beginning at page 197. And so we would rely on those. And the Erdman case, I'm sorry, Your Honor, the Erdman case on breach of warranty, that only goes to actual knowledge of the defect. And the defect in this case is the retracted pole is more dangerous than extended, and our man never knew that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.